A couple of weeks ago, I gave a long introduction of Louis Wolpert, so I won't do it again. So Louis is just going to explain to us. You're going to explain to physicists what they ought to know.
No, hold on. First of all, thank you very much indeed. I love Santa Barbara. I mean, the Institute's nice too. Being here, it's magic. It really is magic. Because there's this meeting on with some very smart developmental biologists next week, I thought I could try and give you some preparation. I mean, you'll interrupt them when they talk, but I thought I'd give you some background. Well, this was Tony's idea. So I've selected out what I thought might be some ideas. I'm not going to give you, and you'll interrupt me as I go along, please. So just it's just worth noting, so I mean it's not principles, that embryos are often Cartesian. That is, they really have three axes or two axes at right angles to one another. And so that in a way, I thought physicists would be pleased that a word that they actually knew came up quite early. I don't want to get you too involved in embryology. Just when it was working. Have I done something wicked here? It's all right. No, it's not. Do you know how to do? You see,
you
I'm not.
Tell us how the spherical symmetry is broken, right? Because physicists love broken symmetry.
Yeah, at some other stage. That's not what I'm going to talk about.
You're not
going to
tell about
that. No, I'm not. Quite a lot is laid down in the egg. So this is just to remind you, here is the frog egg, and this is Xenopus actually, it's a favorite model, and I'm not going to talk much about it, but just to remind you, start off with the egg, and there's quite a lot of patterning in the egg already. There's the so-called animal pole and the ventral pole, and that's all sorted out in the mother. The sperm comes in here, and this will become the ventral side, and that will become the dorsal side. The cells divide, and then it makes a word that you really ought to know, it's called a blastula, and I think it's very important to understand. At this stage, you can mark the cells very easily and find out where they will end up. And the important thing, and I'm well known for a statement, it's not birth, marriage, or death that's the most important event in your life, but gastrulation. What gastrulation is, the cells that are going to form the gut and all the muscles and the bone, at this stage are on the outside of the embryo. And then they have to move inside in a complex set of movements, and that's called gastrulation. And I've lost it again.
What's on the inside?
How did you do this? What must I do to?
Here the battery's running out.
Do you think that's what it is?
Just use a stick.
I'll use a stick. It's all right. Don't worry.
Now, at which stage is still a spherical shell?
Sorry? Yeah, at this stage it's.
At this stage
it's pretty spherical.
It is shell.
Well, no, it's hollowish inside. Yes, it is hollow inside. And then you can see it's not that hollow. It's quite filled up. And then the cells move in. I'm not going to explain that. That will be maybe in the next lecture. It's quite complicated. And then you end up with a larva, and that's it is. And I'm not going to talk about this animal at all. But just to give you a feeling, that's the nature of a developmental process, the frog. And it's just worth noticing, going back, over 100 years, that embryos are what are known, or many embryos, not all, are known as regulative. And the famous experiment is here's a normal embryo at the two-cell stage of the sea urchin. It forms that hollow sphere and it makes a larva. And what Drish did more than 100 years ago, he separated those two cells and each one develops into a normal but smaller larva. It's twinning. So it's not all laid down in the egg. Different animals, different story, but it's just worth, and that's known as regulation. The other thing, which is, I don't want to get you too involved in, but it's worth recognizing that cells change their fate during development. So what you can do is we make fate maps. So here's the early embryo, and we label these cells, and they make these funny little hexagons here, whereas these ones which we've labeled here make this like this. Now, if these cells are not determined, if you take these cells here and put them here, they'll develop into the sort of cells that you have there. So they're not determined. They'll behave according to where you put them. You with me? Whereas they're determined, then if you move them to there, they'll behave from where you took them. Okay? So things change with time. Things are quite labile in many systems. It varies from embryo to embryo. I don't have to explain to you protein synthesis. Here's DNA, read into messenger RNA, and you get protein. You'll interrupt me if you, I don't want to take you through that. Complicated transcription apparatus, terribly important. Whether a gene is transcribed, that is transcribed to make a protein, involves a lot of proteins and a lot of maybe a bending of the DNA determining whether it will actually be transcribed. And some of the parts of the DNA can be a long way away. If the DNA can fold around, enhancers can be a long way away from the gene that they're regulating. It's nasty. It can be quite nasty. And it's a complex transcription apparatus, machinery there. Okay. Genes are a bit boring, frankly. Proteins are the wizards. But the cis regulatory region of the genes determine where and when proteins are made. That is the core of development, as proteins determine the behavior of the cells. If you meet a cell and you don't know what sort of a cell it is, the question you ask is, could you please tell me what special proteins you have? And once you know that, you'll know everything about the cell. There are a lot of housekeeping proteins, you know, the energy and just keeping the thing going, life. But it's the special proteins that give the thing. So, for example, in your red blood cells, yes, hemoglobin, that's the characteristic, keratin and so forth and so on.
And you have to also ask what the history, you don't have to ask what the history of the cell was?
No. You ask what it is at that moment. History matters, I'll come to it in a moment.
The shape of the cell depends on its history,
no? No, and more depends on what it has. What proteins it has depends on its history. What it is now is almost entirely determined by what proteins it has.
So, if I take a red blood cell and put in the right proteins, could turn it into a neuron?
Well, I would reckon that red blood cells are a pretty tricky one, because if you put, you couldn't, because there are a lot of other proteins in the membrane and thing. You would have to change a lot. You would have to change too many special things. But basically, yes. And there is transdetermination, but I don't want to get involved in that. Please, proteins are everything. And sorry, which proteins are made? Just let me go back one. Oh, damn it, what have I done here? Sorry. It's the cis, whether a protein is made or not, is all determined. This is the cis regulatory region. That's the core of development. It's what is bound here and what is required here. And what, sorry, Deborah.
So
Deborah.
You're saying that if you take the proteins inside a certain cell and put them in a different cell, it changes type?
Well, not entirely. But you can certainly, to quite a large extent, yes. If you actually, there's an experiment, for example, the answer is yes. I'm not going to take you through the experiment. It involves cell fusion. Yes.
Okay.
Lewis, you're going too fast for me. You already jumped over the question that I thought was really puzzling.
Who is that?
How do cells decide who they're going to become?
My darling, you're being impatient.
Yeah.
Be patient.
You're going
to... I've only just begun.
Okay. Okay. I thought you jumped over that part.
You're wrong.
Okay.
DNA, sorry, I'm making some general points, and if it's boring, I'm sorry, that's the way it is. DNA is not a blueprint. The embryo contains a generative program. Many people talk about DNA as a blueprint. It's rubbish. The DNA helps provide a generative program, as you'll see.
What program is a little bit vague? How is that program?
We're going to show you. Okay. Now, for example, part of a program, a very common feature, and this is why it's not a blueprint, is the gene X is transcribed. It makes a transcription factor. A transcription factor is a factor that's involved in controlling gene expression. And it can turn gene A on, gene B on, gene C on, gene D off, and gene E on. So there are complicated genetic networks. With the same transcription factor, many downstream targets. It's a real problem and not solved, and I'll come to it in a moment. But there can be many downstream targets of a single transcription factor.
Which sometimes turn on.
Exactly that. Exactly that. Something I'm not going to talk about, because I'm going to talk largely about signaling, is that in systems, for example, like the nematode worm, asymmetric cell division can determine what a cell becomes. That there is cytoplasmic localization of certain proteins, complicated story of how they specified in this part of the cell rather than that, and when it divides, the cell becomes different from that cell. Okay? And the nematode is part, but I'm not going to talk about the nematode, but just that you should know about that. Also, something I'm not going to talk about today, but on Friday I will certainly bring into, and that's morphogenesis, change in shape. Okay, and one of the ways, the main way of things that change shape is that there's localized contraction of microfilaments and actin filaments in one part of a cell, and they become wedge-shaped, and that brings about a change in curvature. And gastrulation partly involves that.
So how do the filaments, which cells?
Precisely, that's my next point, and that the core of development, and what I personally work on, is a term that I actually coined. Oh God, I'm beginning to show off, this is terrible. It's called pattern formation, and that's about spatial organization. But I just also want...
What is it that's contracting?
Actin. Microfilaments called actin. Actin myosin. They're muscle-like proteins, okay?
So it's a structure.
Oh, yes. Structures in the cell can localize. Now, how they become localized and what determines that those cells will contract while the ones next to them, that depends on spatial organization, which is I'm going to talk about in a moment. Just to remind you that another key process is growth. You start off small, you get born, you change your proportions. I'm not going to talk much about growth. It's an important issue. I just also have to tell you that a very complex area, and I'm going to talk about cell signaling, that when a cell signal, and this is one of the words you're just going to have to learn, is wingless. When wingless or wnt signals arrive at the cell membrane, it binds to a receptor and you get this complicated sequence of events before you turn a gene on. It's hideous. This is, I'm giving you a very, very simple version. It's hideous, totally hideous. And just let me remind you that DNA is not a blueprint. The human genome, yes, this is what it looks like. We know that there's wandering, that it has compass, and it's got marriage in it. We know the proteins. This is what it looks like. Impenetrable. That's what it actually means. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediment. But to get from that to this, that's the major problem with the genome.
Of course.
I just took all the words, randomized them, because you cannot read the genome. You can tell what proteins are there, but you cannot read the regulatory regions, so you don't know how to put it together. And that's the major problem of the human genome, or of any genome.
At first I thought it was Shakespeare. It is Shakespeare.
All right, you spotted Shakespeare. Maybe you'd know it was a worm, but you wouldn't know which sort of worm. All right. So, and then my next general point. Yes, I'll give you some details. Don't worry, I haven't gone on too long yet. The cell is more...
When you unscramble it...
Yes.
What is that supposed to represent?
That's what understanding how the genome works during development. Because if I give you a genome... And I say to you, could you please tell me what sort of animal this will develop into? You'll say, oh yes, it's going to have marriage, and it's going to have removed, and so forth, but you haven't got a clue what it looks like. And the problem is to work out how those genes, what order they're...
The sequence of gene expression.
Thank you. The sequence of gene expression, spatially and temporally. And that's the problem. It's nasty. And the last general point I want to make, the cell is more complicated than the embryo. I give another talk on the evolution of the embryo. And the point is this, that the miracle of evolution, I put in inverted commas, I'm a bit of a creationist, but that's another story. The miracle of evolution is the cell. Once the cell evolved, it was downhill all the way. It was trivial. Nothing had to be invented, honestly. And the complexity of development lies in the individual cells, not their interactions with one another. That is trivial by comparison. This, and however complicated you think the cell is...
Even in the brain?
It's the network. But the signaling between them is trivial. It's at the junctions. I would agree. I'm thinking of embryos. The brain, okay. I agree with you, but how? And also the other thing is, however complicated or clever you think a cell is, it's cleverer. That is a firm rule for any cell biologist. Just remember, evolution has been absolutely amazing. And the other point to remember, because I'm going to talk about signaling, the same signals are used again and again and again, and the response, and that's precisely the point, depends upon the cell's history. So you can use the set. They're only, and I'll give you a slide of it, in development, there are only about 5 or 6 grand families of signaling molecules. And they're used again and again and again. And the cells respond differently on different occasions because they have changed due to their history. Okay. So, I'm going to start off with something that is not going to be discussed next week, but I've chosen it because it's the system I've worked on myself. Also, it's something that you can recognize. It's the arm, but it's going to be the chick wing. So at least it's a system that even physicists would recognize. You can recognize, yes, you can recognize this as a hand. And this is the chick embryo, and there's the head, and the wing was going to form here, and the leg bud here, and there's a thickening in the apical ectodermal ridge. Now you may say, why does a wing form here and a leg here, and why are there your neck vertebrae up here and the rib vertebrae here? And the answer is, and it is something I'm going to come back to, and don't try to understand it now, but it's very important. There are a set of genes called HOX genes. They're called HOX genes because it goes back to the term homeotic. A homeotic transformation means you change one structure into another. And Ed Lewis, who got one of the people who got the Nobel Prize, did this. And what happens, there are certain mutations in certain genes, and I'll give you an example later, that can change the fly's antenna into a leg. A mutation in one gene can change the antenna into a leg. That's a homeotic mutation, and the genes involved are called HOX genes. Now, in the fly, which I'm going to talk about a little later, where they were originally discovered, the order in which they are along, they're all on the same chromosome, they're all together. And the order on which they are along the chromosome is the order in which they're expressed in the body. Huh. It's almost like a blueprint, having said it's not a blueprint. So in other words, this gene here is expressed there, this gene here, abdominal B, is expressed at the end. When they found that in the fly, and you are basically flies, you have to understand that, and I will show you that a little later. When they found that in the fly, the same genes are in you, but they just happen, they have duplicated, so instead of having one set, there are 4 sets. And once again, these genes, and this is a little mouse, are expressed in the same order along the chromosome as they are in the body. So D1, HOX D1 is expressed here, HOX D4 is here, and all the way back. How that HOX gene pattern is set up, I might get to today, if not on Friday. But it just tells you that at the stage that I'm already talking, the body is specified. There are genes which determine a great deal. And it's the downstream of those HOX genes. There may be hundreds of downstream targets. We just don't know. Please.
So were you alluding to, is the leg coming out of the head when you take something from downstream?
No. You change one, let me come to it. It's a special story, and I don't want to talk about it now. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the chick wing. It's Cartesian, proximo-distal, anterior-posterior, dorso-ventral, genuinely Cartesian. 3 not totally independent, moderately dependent axes, independent axes. And this is what it looks like in the embryo after 10 days, and you can see there's a humerus, a nice radius ulna, a couple of carpal elements, and then 3 digits, which by tradition are called digit 2, digit 3, and digit 4. Oh, you laugh at the numbering, okay. But anyhow, oh, damn it. No, I'm gone. I can't see what I'm doing. Sorry, kids.
So the 3 digits is not universal.
Amongst chickens.
No, amongst all animals.
No, we're talking about chickens. You've got 5. We'll talk about evolution. Sorry, Tony. Okay, so here we get into some real development now. So here's the early limb bud, yes? And there's a thickening in the ridge, which I'll show you, and that's called the apical ectodermal ridge. But you won't hear about limbs next week, so that doesn't. It's called the AER. And it makes a protein called fibroblast growth factor, which specifies, we claim, it's a bit controversial this, and I don't want to get involved, a region called the progress zone. And at the posterior margin, there's a region called the polarizing region, which expresses a gene which you'll hear quite a lot about probably, called sonic hedgehog. Why is it called sonic hedgehog? Because in the fly, there's a gene, a mutation called hedgehog, which makes the larva a little hedgehoggy. And when they found it in the vertebrates, Cliff Tabin and his friends grew up on the game Sonic Hedgehog. So they called it Sonic Hedgehog. When you discover a gene, you can call it whatever you bloody will like. So Sonic Hedgehog is expressed there. And then the limb bud grows out, dividing everywhere, and then you begin to get cartilage formed in this stuff here. Here's the humerus, then later on the radius and ulna, and then the carpal elements and the digits. This is to show you, well, that's what it looks like. No, it doesn't show you anything. I'm not going to show it to you. That's the apical region. It's quite important. Not only is it a signaling region, but that's why the limb, I don't want to get morphogenesis, it's like the seam on a hot water bottle. It's because it's mechanically, the cells are like that, that it keeps the limb dorsoventrally flattened. You can see that intuitively. Okay.
What's the last thing?
Sorry?
What's the scale bar?
Oh, I don't know.
How big is this thing?
500 microns? Quite small. I can't remember. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. And just to remind you, as I told you, that it's the same set of families. Fibroblast growth factor, EGF, transforming growth factor, hedgehog, wingless, delta cell. These are the signals used again and again in insects, flies, you. Okay. And now we've got to consider, how is that limb patterned? How do you get the cartilages and the digits all to do the right thing? And a model that I put forward, and probably what I'm best known for, is the French flag problem. And here it is. This is the patterning, the spatial organization problem. So you have a set of cells here. Each one, of course, let me give you a better example. And it's one for your chairman, your director. The French president is coming, and you want him to greet him nicely. So you get members of the institute to line up outside with blue, white, and red pieces of paper. Each one has three pieces of paper. And when he arrived, you want them to look like the French flag. But some of your colleagues are furious and bunk off at the last moment. Nevertheless, the group has to look like the French flag. How do you know, if you're an individual, what to do? And the answer is simple. If you know where you are in the line, you can calculate what to do. And that's what cells do. And one way of knowing where you are in the line is to fix the concentration here, fix the concentration here, and then using a threshold, you will always get a French flag, no matter how long the system
is.
So
there's some chemical diffusion?
Yes, the chemical diffusion, chemical gradient, and that chemical, which is graded like that, comes from the term Alan Turing, it's called a morphogen.
But it changes with time, right?
No, we're not talking about time.
No, just one instant in time.
This is when the cells decide what to do. I will show you.
Who decides to start the gradient? Is there a special cell in
there? Sure, I'm going to show you right now. In the developing limb, the gradient is set up by that polarizing region that expresses Sonic Hedgehog. And we think that it sets up a gradient like this across the limb. It's not necessary, please, it's embarrassing, but after all these years, we've never seen the gradient. Okay, but there's very good evidence that it's graded, as I'll show you now, and it may not be in Sonic Hedgehog, it may be in bone morphogenetic protein, but the evidence that it's something graded is very strong, as I'll show you.
What do you mean you've never seen the gradient?
You can't visualize it.
You cannot measure anything?
No.
You couldn't measure anything?
You could measure, but no one's been able to do it for this. But
what's the difficulty? I mean, can't you tag?
Well, they haven't done it. They'll do it with other systems where they've done it with green fluorescent protein, they have, but they haven't done it with this one here yet. They'll do it, they're doing, I'm sure they're doing it at the moment. But just let me show you what happens. So that's the model. You set this up, so at a high concentration you make digit 4, middle one digit 2, 3 and then digit 2. Now you put in another signaling region anteriorly. So it signals to these cells, and so now you have a mirror image gradient, and now you go 4, 3, 2, 2, 3, 4. And that's absolutely standard. Now the evidence, and that was our evidence that it's graded, is to put in a little Sonic Hedgehog. And then if you put in a little, you only get a digit 2 extra. If you add a little bit more, you'll get the 2 and a 3, and if you give the full dose, you'll get 4, 3, 2. And that's the evidence that it's graded. That by raising the concentration of the signal, you get go from 2 to 3 to 4. That's not controversial.
So you extract it?
If you prevent the limb widening and add sufficient Sonic Hedgehog, then you'll go 4, 3, 3, 4. Any combination you've thought of, we've done. No, truly, truly. It goes back
so
a very long
time. The gene can be extracted. And then you inject it into
the... No, I don't want to get into the technology. You can actually take Sonic Hedgehog and put it on a bead. Uh-huh. The protein has been isolated. Okay. Or you can just put in Sonic Hedgehog expressing cells. You graft cells.
Now, in your picture, that's millions of cells. Well, zillions of cells.
No. 500 cells. Or something. I can't remember. Something like not long.
500.
I want to say all signaling... I would say less probably, maybe 100. All signaling in terms of patterning in all developmental systems is probably less than 100 cells. It's very, very local.
Really?
No long-range patterning. Hormones are different.
Uh-huh.
Patterning, everything is done on a very small scale.
Really?
Then it grows. So when your limb bud is laid down, it's less than about a millimeter. We'll talk about growth in a minute. So everything is initially on a very small scale. No long-range signaling, virtually. I can't think of a single good example.
Sorry, after the signaling event happened, there's memory of that?
Oh, sure. Oh, all sorts of genes are turned on. Oh, those signal turns on and that, and the limb, sure, absolutely. It's a little bit more complicated, but I'm just giving you a feeling of what's going on. Now, the question is, how does that signal transmitted of Sonic Hedgehog? It's a tricky issue, and I just want to put this one up to tell you there are three ways in which cells signal to one another. One is by diffusion. You let it out, and it diffuses into things. Another one is direct contact, and there are also special junctions in certain cells called gap junctions, which actually allow direct movement of small molecules between them. Now, in the case of Sonic Hedgehog, it's almost certainly like this, but it's a complex process, and there's a receptacle. I'm not even going to talk about it. And I like this cartoon because it's for me the best image of signal transduction, which is a nightmare. So this is a Rube Goldberg cartoon, and the signal is rain, and the gene that's turned on is the lifting of this umbrella so he can smoke his cigar. So the rain falls on this prune, which lifts this little lever, which lights this lighter, which lights this kettle, which boils the kettle, which blows the whistle, which frightens this monkey, who jumps on the swing, cuts the cord, the birds fly out, and it goes up. That is an extremely simplified version of signal transduction. Extremely simplified. And when I showed this, a friend of mine said, oh, you're such an idiot, Lewis. Point about that, if you remove the monkey, it won't work. And we well know that you can take away all sorts of things. Okay. It's hideously complicated because there are 10, 20 monkeys at least.
Which if you remove...
Sorry?
Which if you remove, destroy the
cancer? I don't know. Signal transduction is not my world. So for the anteroposterior, we have a signaling gradient. For the proximodistal, and this is very controversial, I have to tell you, Cliff Tabin from Harvard has just written a paper saying that we're wrong. We have written a paper saying he's wrong, and I'm not going to get you involved in the controversy. This is not wrong. If you remove that thickening, you truncate the limb. Yes? It gets shorter. That's because you destroy the progress there. And they say it's because there's cell death, but that's another story. When you take off the ridge at certain times, you take it off early, you truncate here. You take it off late, you truncate there. And our model to explain this, our model to explain this is called the progress zone model. And what the progress zone model says is the following. The way cells know where they are along the proximodistal axis is by measuring time. That is, they measure how long they remain in the zone. So these cells that come out early have only been in a short time, will make the humerus. Those that have been in a long time will make the digits. And this is what the controversy is about, and I'm not going to tell you about it. Our experiment shows, sorry? Not the foggiest notion.
What?
Not the foggiest notion.
How do cells measure?
Not the foggiest. Well, I'll tell you in another way. We have no evidence one. Anyhow, Cliff thinks the model's wrong anyhow. So we don't know. But let me just tell you a nice experiment which supports the model. If you irradiate the early limb, so this is the normal limb, one cell cycle, 25 cells come out. That's going to be the humerus. Second cell cycle, another 25 cells come out, radius and ulna. If we irradiate and kill off cells, there are only 5 living cells left. First cell cycle, one cell comes out that's any good. Going to have a lousy humerus. Next cell cycle, 10 cells come out, 5 are good. you see things are getting better. So the prediction was, if you do this, you will lose proximal structures, but distal ones will be perfectly normal. I wouldn't tell you, but that isn't what we found.
But that doesn't tell you it's time.
No, it doesn't. We think it does. Very hard to find another explanation. And Cliff and his colleagues dismissed this experiment in half a sentence. However, it's also just worth noting that if you take the region that's going to give rise to the femur from the leg and put it in the progress zone of the wing, it now makes more distal structures, but remembers it came from the leg and makes toes. There's a dorsoventral system too, that's the third axis, and there is some interaction between the axes. Now remember I told you about those HOX genes? Now those same HOX genes are expressed along the body. You see, cells are... Evolution is lazy. Once it found a clever way of doing things, it used it again and again and again. It did not bother to invent new things. It tinkered, as Francois Jacob said. And these HOX genes are expressed in a very complicated pattern. This is a simplified version. And there are lots of experiments in which these genes have been knocked out. And this is one picture, that if you knock out D13, you lose those regions, you knock out D11, you lose, and so forth and so on. And we simply don't understand the mechanism. The mechanism is totally not understood about the downstream effects of knocking these out. All you see is the phenotype. Okay. Then we come to a nasty problem. Having told you about Sonic Hedgehog and told you about this, consider the following experiment. You take the early limb bud and you separate the overlying layer from the underlying cells, disaggregate the cells, mix them all up, and you take it from the anterior half of the leg, for example, so there's no Sonic Hedgehog there at all. You shove them back in there and you graft it to the flank. It doesn't make a terribly good leg, but you get as respectable a pair of toes as any chicken would be proud to own. We have not the foggiest notion of the mechanism. One possibility is a reaction diffusion mechanism of the Turing type. Do you all know about reaction diffusion? Just let me remind you. An activator has a positive feedback loop. The more of the activator, the more it makes. It also stimulates an inhibitor, which inhibits the activator. If you choose the right chemical rate constants and the right diffusion constants, you can start with them at normal concentrations and then you'll get a peak, and you can get multiple peaks. We have no idea whether that's the way those little things are organized or not, and I know of nowhere in the whole of developmental biology where this particular mechanism, attractive as it is known to work. And just to remind you about the evolution of the limb, and coming back to the number of digits, you can see, and just to see how it's changed, for example, here's our one, here's the bat, in which the digits have become very long, and here's the horse in which things have fused together, and the middle one has become very long to become the thing. And it's quite easy to understand how those could have happened. I'm not going to take you through that. So, what I hoped I've shown you there, really, in a sort of crudish way, we haven't got into molecular details, but it's a plausible way of thinking about the development of the limb. And now what I want to come on to is the system we really understand best in all of development. We understand the nematode too, but we're more like a fly. So I want to talk about the fly, and this is Drosophila. And so first of all, just let me show you, there's the egg. Then it becomes segmented and you get a larva, and here it is. Where is it? So here's the egg, which is fertilized. Now what's very important to understand about the fly is, first of all, the mother does a lot of patterning of the egg, which I'll show you. Secondly, the early cell divisions are of the nucleus only, so there are no boundaries between the cells. It's multinucleate. It's a big cell with lots of nuclei. And all the key early patterning is done in effectively a single cell with hundreds of nuclei. That's the way it is. So there's the fertilized egg and its cleavage, and that's why it's called a syncytial blastoderm, because there are no membranes between the cells. And a lot of patterning occurs there, as I'll show you. And then you get gastrulation, you hatch and you get a starva, and then you get a larva, you get a pupa and metamorphosis. Okay. And just look at this nice thing, but I'll show you all this very quickly. And this is just another picture to show you. Very, very Cartesian, anteroposterior dorsiventral. I'm not going to talk about dorsiventral. I'm only going to talk about anteroposterior. But the dorsiventral is extremely well understood. And Mike Levine, who's coming, I think, has made major contributions to all sorts of stuff along here. But I'm not going to talk about that. And here's the head region, and there's the abdomen. And eventually you get this larva with three thoracic segments and eight abdominal segments, and you get a little special structure here and a little special structure of the tail. Okay. And there are very special patterns of bristles on all of these, and we have to understand how that comes about. And a little later on, the larva with these segmental structures, which starts up there called parasegments, and we'll see how it becomes segmented in a moment, gives rise to these segments in the larva, which then metamorphoses into the adult. But let's look at the beginning. So here's the key. In the egg, the mother lays down at the anterior end a maternal messenger RNA in a very key gene called bicoid. Okay? So it's the messenger RNA. And the mother lays this down thing. There are also some other ones laid down elsewhere. And what happens is, I'm going to show you, that maternal gene is then translated, the messenger RNA is translated, and sets up a gradient, and that leads to the expression of gap genes. And the gap genes along here, the ones divided up, gives rise to the pair rule genes, which foreshadow segmentation. And that's as far as I'm going to take you. But that's really quite important. So here it is. Here's the maternal messenger RNA in the egg. You can visualize it. It's translated at fertilization, and it sets up a most beautiful gradient in a bicoid protein. It is the best example of a gradient that provides positional information in the whole of embryology. It's beautiful and wonderful and reliable. Now what happens is, the cells, the nuclei, remember it's not cells, so anything can diffuse through here. There are many, many nuclei. But the transcription, bicoids are transcription factor can diffuse. At a particular threshold, the gene hunchback is turned on. And here is hunchback. At this threshold here, hunchback is turned on. So hunchback now is expressed in the anterior half of the embryo. Messenger RNA is made, and messenger RNA is translated, and a gradient in hunchback will be set up. What's interesting, you can put in 6 doses of hunchback, of bicoid, so that you have a much steeper gradient, and then what you'll find then is that hunchback is expressed in a much wider range. A very important paper, which includes Liebler, who's, I think, a theoretical physicist, isn't it, has shown that this particular system is unbelievably reliable, and they haven't a clue why. But it's very robust and unbelievably reliable and consistent in ways they do not understand. And it's a paper he wrote with Eric Wischhaus, who will be here next week, so you can certainly discuss it with him. And they end the paper saying, we need to find out why is it so reliable.
You don't need to tell us what hunchback does, right?
Be patient.
But robustness to what? The disturbing?
Slight disturbances and slight variations, and yet the hunchback comes up in exactly the right place. And the gradient is very reliable. I've only glanced at the paper, but it's something that Eric Wischhaus, I think, but it's a paper in Nature about a year or so ago. Very important. There's a degree of reliability there which nobody fully understands. Really, because they analyzed lots of different embryos to see how constant it was, and was unbelievably reliable, and even when slightly perturbed. So the gradient turns on, and it turns on genes like giant. Cripple is turned on by bicoid. There are a whole lot of other so-called gap genes are turned on. So we've gone from the simple gradient with further gradients, and you make all, you turn on genes in different place. So the embryo, which was pretty uniform apart from bicoid, is now divided up. There are proteins expressed in all sorts of different places.
So these are turned on all by the same gradient.
No.
Some other.
Hunchback plays a major role there. And there's also slight interaction. So bicoid turns on some of them, and hunchback the others.
But indirectly, they're all being turned on.
Sorry?
Indirectly, they're all turned on by the gradient.
But indirectly, yes. Yes. Yes, indirectly, yes.
Giant looks a much better.
I can't remember. I'm not a Drosophila person, but that's what happens, I promise you. And it's only due to those gradients, and it's been extremely well studied, this. And there are also interactions between, for example, there will be an interaction between giant and cripple so they don't overlap and they're the right distance away. Sorry, Deborah.
How, on what time scale do these gradients decay away?
Oh, I can't tell you that, but this whole process is over in a few hours.
And there's a sequential turn on of the...
Yes, absolutely. Sequential.
So if one would somehow do the experiment where you forget about the bicoid but put hunchback artificially...
You get exactly what you would expect. Exactly what you would expect. But hold on, the drama is still to come. Because from that, you get this. And that foreshadows segmentation.
Is it still one giant cell?
One giant cell. These stripes are about three cells wide, three or four cells wide.
Concentrations of nuclei?
No, that's gene expression. These are pair-rule genes, and each pair-rule gene, I can't remember, they're 13 stripes or 11, I can never remember, doesn't matter. They're expressed in every alternate stripe. So the gene I'm going to talk about is called even-skipped. It's expressed in every odd stripe, okay? So it will be here. Do you understand the thing? I can't remember the thing. And there are about five or six pair-rule genes. Only three cells wide, eh? Now, I've written...
It was one giant cell.
Three nuclei. Sorry, thank you very much, Deborah. Three nuclei wide. No cells yet. I've written a book called The Unnatural Nature of Science. And in this book, I argue that any common sense view about the way the world works is scientifically false. I mean, for example, that force causes acceleration, not motion, still drives me mad. Doesn't matter. This is the best example I know in science. Everybody, when I saw this, said, oh, there's clearly a wave-like function underlying this. And they saw simulated Turing equations. It is not like that. And Mike Levine played a major role in this. The answer is simply amazing. Every one of those stripes is specified totally independently from every other. Even as I say it, I can hardly believe it, but it's true. And I will give you one. It's mind-blowing. I think it's the most important idea in the whole of developmental biology. What I'm going to show you in the next slide, I regard as the most important concept in the whole of developmental biology. Okay. And here it is. So there are 14 stripes, I forgot, sorry. And we're looking at even skipped, which is expressed in 1-3, all the way. And we're going to look at the second even skipped stripe. And we're going to look in that region. And we're going to look at the proteins. And we see there's bicoid, there's hunchback, there's cripple, and there's giant. And it turns out that a giant inhibits even skipped 2, cripple inhibits even skipped 2, but hunchback and bicoid stimulated, and that's why it's on here. So the whole point is, there's a separate CISC regulatory region for the even-skipped second stripe, and it integrates the local inflammation. And there's a separate regulatory region for every one of the other even-skipped stripes, and for all the other stripes. It is the most important, I think, and Eric Davidson, who's coming next week, will drive you mad with cis regulatory regions in the sea urchin, which I'll tell you about in a moment. But this is the core of development.
Sorry? End up differently, functionally?
No, they don't actually.
They're identical?
Very similar.
I'm confused. I thought some stripes...
Oh, yeah, but that's for a different reason. Oh, the stripe. No, some of these stripes will end up in the thorax and some in the abdomen. But that's nothing to do with the pair-rule genes. This is about segmentation. And some of the stripes will be slight. But each stripe is specified totally independently of the others. Sorry, that's the way it is.
Okay, but why is that so... But you're saying each stripe is different.
No. Each even skipped stripe expresses exactly the same gene, even skipped.
But what about other things?
No. nothing else. Well, we'll see about that in a moment. But the why it's turned on there is because it's got a separate regulatory region. Each one of those stripes has a separate regulatory region. Please.
Are those regulatory regions in any way resembled the order in these stripes are, or?
Not that I know of. It may be, but I don't know. I've never heard that. Please.
The stripes all seem to have the same width.
Yes, they do. Yes, range. They do. No idea. No idea.
Still trying to understand the content of the surprise and what it is that we would otherwise have expected.
Well, wouldn't you have thought there would have been a wave-like function specifying them?
Yeah, where does the width come from?
Not the wave. It comes from this.
Even if there's the same, different sort of
proteins.
There'll be a difference at over this here. There'll be another control region. I don't know which genes are involved for one, but there'll be a different set, and there'll be a different regulatory region,
which
will specify even skipped in region one.
The reason that it has to be a different regulatory region is because the actual proportions of bicoid and so forth.
Sure, absolutely. Yes. And I can't remember, maybe giant is involved. We haven't drawn any other things in that region.
A different regulatory region for the same gene.
For the same gene. Seven different regulatory regions for every Perul gene.
You're saying that instead of the pattern came first and then we figure out. How
it evolved, that's another story. Don't let's get involved in that.
I still don't understand how from what you've said so far, you don't know that there's some sort of inhibition, lateral inhibition or
there
something
isn't.
That creates the...
No, there isn't. There's no evidence for it whatsoever. You can talk to Mike Levine about it. Remember, this is not my world. You ask Mike when he comes next week. It's no evidence that I've heard of, because they've done millions of experiments along this. And it's not for me to think. Sorry. That's protein up here, yes, all protein.
In principle, how do you keep protein profiles of crisp? You're talking about what ones they will diffuse.
They do diffuse and they break down. Exactly that. How do you keep it so crisp? And as I told you, the bicoid one, that's what the thing, very hard. These are not answered questions that I know of. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask a real Drosophila person. It's not mine. Sorry. Not that I'm trying to avoid it. I'm telling you what the story. And
Has this been tested?
Oh yes. Oh, this is biblical. And here's the bind. We even know where the binding. Look, here's the binding regions for even skip two. This is where bicoid binds on that control region, and this is where the activators bind, and this is where they even know where they bind. Please. Yeah, yes.
In the odds, right? Just because even skipped, and it's the identical gene expressed in every odds, right? It doesn't mean that the nuclei are identical.
I never said the nuclei were identical.
The nuclei in the odd stripes, are they identical?
Of course. Of course.
No other, because there's lots of other proteins that could be expressed.
No, but they're not identical because of those different proteins that are around. And also there are lots of other Perul genes, there's Fushi Teratsu and all sorts, And they're all this based on the same principle.
Is this common to other?
No, because you just must remember, these transcription factors do not have to cross a cell membrane. They're diffusing within a single cell. But the principle is still pretty important. And when you come to the sea urchin, which I'll come to in a moment, complex cis-regulatory genes, I regret, are the core of development. I'll show you that in a moment. Please. That's all right.
The concentrations of, let's say, bicoid.
Yes.
So they must have different effects, obviously.
Of course, they do.
So how can the concentration affect the sort of Boolean combinations of things that can happen.
That's what regulatory regions are about. They integrate the local protein concentrations and decide whether to be on or off. That's exactly what it's about. So when these bind in this particular way, it's on.
What's the relative percentage of the concentrations typically?
No, I can't answer that. I'm not a Drosophila person. Sorry. I can't answer that. I cannot answer. Now, just let's go on with that. After this, you get cell borders. You actually get cells. You actually get cell membranes around. So now we have a cell, and this is what the ventral view of the larva looks like. It becomes segmented, quite complicated, but each one of these patterns of bristles is different. Any Drosophila person, if you showed them this in a better picture, would say, oh, that's the third abdominal segment. You know, I can't do that. Sorry, but really, they can recognize all sorts of things. And this is about segment polarity. And Gary O'Dell will talk about the robustness of this next week. God, I'm going on a bit. Okay, so this is the normal thing. So in these segments, there's also the concept of compartments. I didn't bloody well put in a picture of compartments. When these become cellularized, there's a peculiar feature that the different segments comprise a compartment. And what it means is that there's a boundary that cells from one side never move across it. It may involve cell adhesion, doesn't matter. Just believe me, what's more, that the genes control a particular group of cells in a compartment and have no influence directly on the other one, okay? So all the nonsense I've heard about modules at this meeting, these are genuine modules. This is a genuine module compartments, and I could explain more about that. And here is the compartment boundary. And what happens is that that's the segment boundary, and you see there's a very special pattern of bristles. And it's partly, I'm not going to take you through, it involves wingless and hedgehog and engrailed, and there are all sorts of signals here. Now, if you make a mutation, then this whole thing gets screwed up. And this is what O'Dell will tell you about in terms of robustness, because they have simulated many of the genes involved here, because there are many genes involved, and they claim that over a wide range of parameters, this still works. It's robust. I don't want to go on too long. I've gone on longer than I even wanted to. And this, you asked, how do they become? This is the Hox gene complex in the insect, and where these are turned on, and it involves perule genes and bicoid and all sorts of genes, that determines that these are turned on in the head region and these are turned on in the body region. And that's the Hox gene complex. And you can get all sorts of interesting mutations. I think, don't you think you've had enough? Do you want me to take you through discs? 5 minutes on discs?
Discs.
Few more minutes.
Sure.
You sure? Okay. So we've spoken about the larva. Mm-hmm. And now you must understand, where does the adult come from? It's weird. It's really weird. And that's why I talked to you about the limb first. Because it's the adult is carried around in little packages in the larva. And they're called immortal discs. So here's the larva. And it's going along and behaving like a nice larva. And you have these little sheets of cells. This little sheet here is going to give rise to the leg. This one's going to give rise to the genitals. This one's going to give rise to the wing. So the package for the adult is in what are called immarginal discs, which are carried around. And at metamorphosis, they all join up in the right way to give you a fly. I'm not going to take you through.
What's the gray region?
That's the whatchamacallit, that's the larva.
So the gray region just has nothing in it.
Well, it does make some contribution to these segments here. But as far as all the external things like that, like the eye and the antenna and the legs and the wing, that's all packaged. A bit of the body comes from the larva, but all the external things are packaged. Sorry?
Put together.
Yes, exactly that. It's amazing.
The links between them?
Please, I'm not a Drosophila person. But it's well known. No, they know it. I just want to tell you. And one of the best systems, and although Steve Cohen's not here, Telemann will tell you about the wing disc. One of the best patterning systems we know of in all of development is the wing disc. And I'm going to give you the wing in 2 minutes. Just let me remind you about homeotic mutations. I told you, that's the head of the fly. And what you can see here, that's a leg, and that's the antenna, One single mutation will turn the one into the other.
And animals don't have blood.
Of course they have hemolymph, yes. Blood schmud, don't let's get involved in that. Just let me tell you, there's a single mutation which turns the one single gene, the antennapedia, turns this into a leg. Yes?
Right. One now, module into another one.
Yes. Because they both have the same positional information. They have the same gradients. All the discs have the same gradients. It's the interpretation that varies. Identical positional information, virtually.
So you're suggesting you could turn it into a wing? Or an
I'm not a Drosophila. I cannot tell you that. But you can turn halteres. I can't tell you all the transformations. It's not my thing. However, what it is basically this, that cells use the same positional information. And if you got a group of cells that are going to give rise to the Union Jack, and at an early stage you put them into a French flag system, then they behave according to their position and their genome, and they form this bit of the Union Jack. And experiments with that leg and antenna show exactly that. So depending on where the mutation is put, it behaves according to its position and genetic constitution. Okay. So now we come to the wing, and this is what the wing disc looks like, and it starts off as a flat sheet, a virtual a little two-thing sheet, and the patterning, and Steve Cohen has played a major thing here, and then it's all patterned, and at metamorphosis it simply folds out and gives you the wing. So there's no patterning when it looks like that, it's all done in there. And the basic idea, I'm only going to be very brief on that, is the following. Is that various genes are expressed in the wing disc of the fly. There's an anteroposterior thing, a gene called engrailed, it's everywhere. It's expressed posteriorly. Hedgehog is expressed posteriorly too, and where hedgehog meets non-hedgehog, the gene decapentaplegic is turned on. Decapentaplegic is a morphogen. Sorry, these are terrible names. And it sets up a gradient, as I'll show you. I'm not going to talk about the other axis, but it is a two-dimensional axis. And I think this I'll make this my last slide. And what happens is, remember I told you the decapentaplegic, a gradient is set up at the middle there, and at various thresholds, you turn on other genes. And what Telemann will tell you about are the details. It's a complex story of how you specify this gradient as to how you read it and so forth. I think we should stop. Enough is enough. And if you come on Friday, I will tell you about how your vertebrae are put in the right place, about cis-regulatory genes, and also morphogenesis, about change in shape.
And are you going to tell us about senescence?
No.
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 How about symmetry in your...
I'll talk a little bit about, if you want to, I can talk about left-right asymmetry.
Right.
Asymmetry.
Now that is always really mysterious to me, how the two arms of a human's come out the same length and so on. In your book you said there's no communication.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. So they grow for 16 years.
For 16 years they grow.
And they grow and they end up on the whole... And as you well know, it's a major feature of animals.
Right.
That the way a female chooses a male,
right.
They look for symmetry.
Exactly.
They want to make sure they're developing nicely.
Right.
Come on, it's enough.
But they grow by the cells just keep dividing, right?
It's a bit more complex. If you want me to tell you about that next time, I will. How do we know there's no communication?
Questions?
Oh, easily, because you can cut off the one that has no effect on the other whatsoever.
No, that doesn't prove.
Oh, sure.
Just prove cutting off one, doesn't it?
No, but there's absolutely no communication between them. Absolutely none. It's absolutely obvious. Because you could do anything you like to the one, it has no effect on the other. How else would you ever know?
You don't have a control experiment where you measure the growth of the same arm and the same person with this one cut
off. Oh, no, we don't use people, we use mice and chickens.
How do you know a single organism, there isn't
No, that's I can give a lecture on growth. In some there are. In fact, my debate with Boris next week is on precisely this issue, on what controls size.